Black rednecks. Much of the cultural pattern of Southern rednecks became the cultural heritage of Southern blacks, more so than survivals of African cultures with which they had not been in contact for centuries. Even in colonial times, most blacks on American soil had been born on American soil. Moreover, such cultural traits followed blacks out of the southern countrysides and into the urban ghettos, north and south, where many settled. The very way of talking, later to be christened Black English, closely followed dialects brought over from those parts of Britain from which many white southerners came, though these speech patterns died out in Britain while surviving in the American South, as such speech patterns would later die out among most southern whites and among middle-class blacks, while surviving in the poorer black ghettos around the country. For example, where a northerner said, "I am," "you are," "she isn't," "it doesn't," and "I haven't," a Virginian, even of high rank, preferred to say, "I be," "you be," "she ain't," "it don't," and "I ain't." These Virginia speech ways were not invented in America. They derived from a family or regional dialects that had been spoken throughout the South and West of England during the 17th century. From these same regions of England came such words as yaller for yellow, axe for ask, acrost for across, y'all for you, bile for boil, dough for door, dis for this, and dat for that. Many of these usages have long since died out in England, though the word chitlins for hog entrails continued to be used in some localities in England, even in the 20th century, as such usage remained common among black Americans. But no such words came from Africa, nor did the holiday Kwanzaa, which originated in Los Angeles. The slaves' custom of marking their marriages by jumping over a broomstick, a custom resurrected at a posh wedding among blacks in 20th century New York as a mark of racial identity, was in fact a pagan custom in Europe in centuries past and survived for a time among southern whites. Complaints about the improvidence of whites in the South and of their ancestors in Britain before that were echoed in W.E.B. Du Bois's picture of his fellow blacks in the 1890s. Probably few poor nations waste more money by thoughtless and unreasonable expenditure than the American Negro, and especially those living in large cities. Thousands of dollars are annually wasted in amusements of various kinds and in miscellaneous ornaments and gewgaws. The Negro has much to learn of the Jew and the Italian as to living within his means and saving every penny from excessive and wasteful expenditures. It was not, however, from Jews or Italians that blacks had absorbed their culture. Du Bois's description of the spending habits of blacks in the 1890s was echoed by a contemporary observer, Jacob Riis, who said that the Negro loves fine clothes and good living a good deal more than he does a bank account. Similar observations have been made by many others over the years, inside and outside the black community. For the lower socioeconomic classes among blacks, Gunnar Myrdal's descriptions of them near the middle of the 20th century still bore a remarkable resemblance to descriptions of southern whites and their regional forebears in Britain, including less resourcefulness, disorganized family life, lax sexual morals, and recklessness, with tendencies toward aggression and violence. Despite a generally sympathetic approach to the study of blacks in his landmark book, An American Dilemma, which has often been credited with a major influence on the advancement of civil rights, Myrdal also noted the low standards of efficiency, reliability, ambition, and morals actually displayed by the average Negro. He observed something of the devil-may-care attitude in the pleasure-seeking of Negroes, and a general attitude in which life becomes cheap and crime not so reprehensible. Like other observers, Myrdal tended to attribute to slavery such aspects of black culture as the low regard for human life, when in fact antebellum whites had exhibited this same reckless disregard of lethal dangers and so had their ancestors in Britain. Unlike many others, however, Myrdal also recognized the influence of the southern white culture on the culture of blacks, pointing out that the general southern pattern of illegality maintained this low regard for human life. He also noted that the so-called Negro dialect is simply a variation on the ordinary southern accent, that religious emotionalism was borrowed from and sanctioned by religious behavior among whites in the South, and that the Negro trait of audaciousness is characteristic of white southerners too. He quoted black scholar and later statesman Ralph Bunche. White Southerners employ many of the defense mechanisms characteristic of the Negro. They often carry a chip on the shoulder. They indulge freely in self-commiseration. They rather typically and in real Negro fashion try to overcome a feeling of inferiority by exhibitionism, raucousness in dress, and exaggerated self-assertion. Although Dr. Bunche presented these as parallels, historically it was, of course, the Southern whites who first had these patterns, reflecting patterns among their ancestors in Britain. In much of the literature on black culture, however, the supposed influence of slavery has been far more sweepingly assumed, and the cultural influence of white Southerners and their forebears in Britain largely ignored. Attempts to derive the black manner of speaking from slavery and its parallel among whites as an influence from black speech were answered by a Southern historian who asked, "From whence came the drawl of the people of the upper Great Plains and of the Blue Ridge, Smoky, and Cumberland Mountains, who have had little or no contact with the Negro?" Another cultural historian of Southerners aptly observed that Southerners, white and black, share the bonds of a common heritage, indeed a common tragedy, and often speak a common language, however seldom they may acknowledge it. Half a century after Myrdal, another study of racial attitudes noted the intimidating ethnic style of many underclass black males, and noted that nearly half of all murder victims in America were black, and that 94% of them were killed by other blacks. Many of these killings were due to gang members who killed for such reasons as, "'cause he look at me funny, cause he give me no respect," and other reasons reminiscent of the touchy pride and hair-trigger violence of rednecks and crackers in an earlier era. The neglect and disdain of education found among antebellum white Southerners has been echoed not only in low performance levels among ghetto blacks, but perhaps most dramatically in a hostility toward those black students who are conscientious about their studies, who are accused of acting white, a charge that can bring anything from social ostracism to outright violence. So much attention has been paid to questions of ability that few have looked at cultural attitudes. One of those who has is black professor and best-selling author Shelby Steele, who sees in many of these children almost a determination not to learn, even though, once outside the school and in their own neighborhoods, these same children learn everything. He drew on his own experiences teaching at a university. "For some years, I have noticed that I can walk into any of my classes on the first day of the semester, identify the black students, and be sadly confident that on the last day of the semester, a disproportionate number of them will be at the bottom of the class, far behind any number of white students of equal or even lesser ability." Statistical data substantiate these impressions. Black students typically perform academically below the level of those white students with the same mental test scores, in contrast to Asian American students, who perform better than white students with the same test scores as themselves. In short, even though black students average lower test scores than either white or Asian American students, those test scores are not necessarily the sole, nor perhaps even the predominant, reason for lower black academic achievement. Indeed, it is possible that the lower test scores may be a result of cultural attitudes, and of actions or inactions over a period of years based on those attitudes, more so than a cause of academic failures. While it has long been known that, historically, the average IQ of blacks has been about 85, compared to a national average of 100, what has not been so widely known is that the average IQ of blacks in the North was for years consistently higher than that of blacks in the South. A 1942 study of freshmen at black colleges found the superiority of freshmen from Northern schools over those from Southern schools was found to persist throughout the colleges. As already noted, black soldiers from some northern states scored higher on mental tests than whites from some southern states during the First World War. From that same era, European immigrants from cultures where education was not a high priority for ordinary people, parts of Eastern and Southern Europe, for example, scored no higher on mental tests than American blacks, and, in some communities, their children scored lower than northern black children attending the same schools. The low test scores of some European immigrant children cannot be automatically attributed to their being new to the United States. There have been settled communities of whites with test scores similar to those of blacks, where these have been culturally isolated people, such as the inhabitants of the Hebrides Islands off Scotland, or people living in Tennessee mountain communities, hillbillies, or inhabitants of canal boat communities in Britain. In short, some kinds of cultures tend to produce lower mental test scores, whether the people in those cultures are black or white, American or European. As someone has aptly said, the tests are not unfair. Life is unfair, and the tests measure the results. No one chooses which culture to be born into, or can be blamed for how that culture evolved in centuries past. In business ownership, as in other ways, the pattern among black Americans has followed the pattern of rednecks in earlier times, with people from other groups owning most of the businesses in black neighborhoods. Some may try to explain the lack of locally owned businesses in the ghettos by racial discrimination or poverty, but as early as the 1920s, there were numerous black-owned businesses in Harlem, the majority of which were owned by blacks from the Caribbean, not blacks from the American South, who were the majority population of Harlem. Although New York was the principal destination of blacks from the Caribbean, then as now, the 1930 census showed that there were more than four times as many native-born blacks in Manhattan as there were foreign-born blacks. In a parallel to differences between Southern and non-Southern whites, a study of West Indian blacks in the United States noted that the Negro immigrants, particularly the British West Indians, bring a zest of learning that is not typical of the native-born population. While black Americans have long been overrepresented among people in prison, a study of the racial composition of New York State's Sing Sing prison in the early 1930s found that black West Indians were underrepresented relative to their share of the population, at a time when native-born black Americans were overrepresented several-fold among Sing Sing inmates. During that same era, when American-born black women and West Indian black women both worked in New York City's garment district, the latter were more frequently found at the skilled tasks. More generally, the study found that the black immigrant brings a cultural heritage that is vastly different from that of the American Negro. The first black borough presidents of Manhattan were West Indians. As late as 1970, the highest-ranking blacks in New York's police department were West Indians, as were all the black federal judges in the city. The 1970 census showed that black West Indian families in the New York metropolitan area had 28% higher incomes than the families of American blacks. The incomes of second-generation West Indian families living in the same area exceeded that of black families by 58%. Neither race nor racism can explain such differences, nor can slavery, since native-born blacks and West Indian blacks both had a history of slavery. Studies published in 2004 indicated that an absolute majority of the black alumni of Harvard were either West Indian or African immigrants, or the children of these immigrants. Somewhat similar findings have emerged in studies of some other elite colleges. With blacks, as with whites, the redneck culture has been a less achieving culture. Moreover, that culture has affected a higher proportion of the black population than of the white population, since only about one-third of all whites lived in the antebellum South, while nine-tenths of all blacks did. From the 1960s onward, much of the transplanted Southern culture would, like black English, be seen as sacrosanct features of a distinctive black identity, despite their mirroring very similar cultural patterns among Southern whites in times past. Not all black Americans, of course, retain this anachronistic culture, for the spread of education and the growing experience of the counterproductive effects of the Southern redneck way of life eroded it over time for many blacks, as happened also among the whites who brought this culture over from Britain. Even during the era of slavery, those blacks who were house servants in more educated homes tended to pick up a different culture, giving their descendants enduring advantages over the descendants of field hands. Contemporary black ghetto culture in the United States is not, however, a simple linear extrapolation from the culture of Southern whites. First of all, most black Americans today are no longer part of the ghetto culture. Moreover, aside from influences peculiar to the circumstances of blacks, profound changes in the larger American society around them have also had an influence, both positive and negative. The burgeoning of the American welfare state in the second half of the 20th century and the declining effectiveness of the American criminal justice system at the same time allowed borrowed and counterproductive cultural traits to continue and flourish among those blacks who had not yet moved beyond that culture, thereby prolonging the life of a chaotic, counterproductive, dangerous, and self-destructive subculture in many urban ghettos. Crime and violence were among the features of this subculture that were artificially prolonged. Prior to the 1960s, while black males had a higher murder rate than other males, their murder rate was also declining more sharply than the general murder rate. Subsequently, the general murder rate in the United States and the murder rate for black males both reversed and began rising sharply, that of black males more sharply than others. In short, the drastic changes in law enforcement and social morality during the 1960s had particularly adverse effects on the behavior and actions of blacks and on black victims of the criminals in their midst. Intellectuals have also played a role, along with the welfare state, in prolonging and legitimizing a counterproductive culture among blacks. Nowhere was the effect of the white liberalism of the 1960s on the social evolution of black culture more devastating than in the disintegration of the black family. The raw facts are these. As of 1960, 51% of black females between the ages of 15 and 44 were married and living with their husbands. Another 20% were divorced, widowed, or separated. And only 28% had never been married. 20 years later, only 31% of black women in these age brackets were married and living with their husbands, while 48% had never married. By 1994, an absolute majority, 56%, of black women in these age brackets were never married, and only 25% were married and living with their husbands. Accordingly, while 2/3 of black children were living with both parents in 1960, only 1/3 were by 1994. While only 22% of black children were born to unmarried women in 1960, 70% were by 1994. White liberals, instead of comparing what has happened to the black family since the liberal welfare state policies of the 1960s were put into practice, compare black families to white families, and conclude that the higher rates of broken homes and unwed motherhood among blacks are due to a legacy of slavery. But why the large-scale disintegration of the black family should have begun 100 years after slavery is left unexplained. Whatever the situation of the black family relative to the white family, in the past or the present, it is clear that broken homes were far more common among blacks at the end of the 20th century than they were in the middle of that century or at the beginning of that century, even though blacks at the beginning of the 20th century were just one generation out of slavery. The widespread and casual abandonment of their children and of the women who bore them by black fathers in the ghettos of the late 20th century was, in fact, a painfully ironic contrast with what had happened in the immediate aftermath of slavery 100 years earlier, when observers in the South reported desperate efforts of freed blacks to find family members who had been separated from them during the era of slavery. A contemporary journalist reported meeting black men walking along the roads of Virginia and North Carolina, many of whom had walked across the state or across more than one state looking for their families. Others reported similar strenuous and even desperate efforts of newly freed blacks to find members of their families. New England enclaves. It should be noted again that not all blacks today are part of the redneck culture. Far from it. Nor has that culture been the only culture in which blacks lived in the past. There were small but significant enclaves of New England culture introduced into southern black communities by teachers from New England who poured into the South immediately after the end of the Civil War to establish schools and to teach and acculturate the children of freed slaves. Often, these were the only schools available for black children, because the South was slow to begin establishing public schools, especially for blacks. W.E.B. Du Bois called the work of these dedicated missionaries the finest thing in American history. By 1866, just 1 year after the Civil War ended, there were about 1,400 northern white teachers from dozens of religious missionary associations teaching black children in 975 southern schools. The numbers, suggesting that these were mostly the kinds of one-room schoolhouses common at the time in rural areas, which is where most Southern blacks lived. Just a few years later, at the end of the decade, there were more than 2,500 Northern teachers in just over 2,000 schools for black children. A sample of about 1,000 of these teachers whose origins could be traced showed that more than 500 came directly from New England, and the others are believed to include people born in New England but who came south directly from some other location. To put this in perspective, only 17% of the Northern population lived in New England at the time, so this was a wholly disproportionate representation of New Englanders among those who began to educate newly emancipated blacks. This was a New England-led crusade, much like the pre-war abolitionist movement, and many of those who went into the postbellum South were former abolitionists. These teachers brought a wholly different culture into the South. In the words of distinguished black scholar E. Franklin Frazier, "The missionaries from New England who founded the first schools for Negroes in the South left the imprint of their Puritan background upon Negro education. In addition to strict morality, these missionaries taught the Yankee virtues of industry and thrift. This cultural transformation was not incidental. The avowed purpose of the American Missionary Association was to transplant a different culture into the school and college enclaves which they established among young blacks in the South, in order to deliberately supplant the existing culture. These were deeply religious institutions, but in the New England sense, so that black students were not to indulge in the religious emotionalism of the black masses in the South. They were to be different in many other ways, as E. Franklin Frazier noted. First, students were taught to speak English correctly, and thus avoid the ungrammatical speech and dialect of the Negro masses. They were expected to be courteous, speak softly, and never exhibit the spontaneous boisterousness of ordinary Negroes. The casual Southern attitude toward sex was not tolerated. To be detected in immoral sex behavior, especially if the guilty person was a woman, meant expulsion from the school. The American Missionary Association was quite explicit in their desire to remove black youngsters from their existing culture and place them in enclaves of the culture transplanted from the North. In an 1882 essay titled "Change of Environment," Dr. W. W. Patton, president of the AMA, lamented that many black children grow up in communities of prevailing ignorance, superstition, and immorality, where they live in miserable hovels, see only examples of coarseness and rudeness, and hear only a Negro dialect, when what was needed was a total change of environment by removing young people to places where morals are pure, where manners are refined, where language is grammatical. Far from celebrating the existing culture of the black community, Dr. Patton declared, "All improvement must be by an influence from without, which shall quicken and inspire, which shall teach and guide." This being the purpose of planting and strengthening the educational institutions which operate to change for the better the environment of the colored race in this country. Although there was another educational tradition established at the Hampton Institute in Virginia and transplanted to Tuskegee Institute in Alabama by Booker T. Washington, a graduate of Hampton, this tradition as well was based on replacing the existing culture of Southern blacks with a new imported culture. Hampton Institute's founder, General Samuel Chapman Armstrong, declared that the average Negro student needed a residential boarding school that could control the entire 24 hours of each day. Only thus can old ideas and ways be pushed out and new ones take their place. Addressing the American Missionary Association in 1877, the principal of Hampton Institute said, "There is no lack of those who have mental capacity. The question with him is not one of brains, but of right instincts, of morals, and of hard work." Contrary to later caricatures, neither Hampton Institute nor Tuskegee Institute was based on an assumption that blacks had the capacity to be only hewers of wood and drawers of water. In short, however divergent the different schools of thought were on educational philosophy, as between the Hampton-Tuskegee approach and the approach of the founders of other institutions for blacks, they were agreed that what was most needed for the advancement of blacks in the postbellum South was the replacement of the culture prevailing around them and among them by a new imported culture. However, the greatest obstacle to creating this new culture was the existing black redneck culture. For many missionaries, the physical problems of overwork, illness, and poor facilities were less frustrating than their everyday dealing with the freedmen. A constant problem for teachers was student absenteeism. A pupil would attend school for a few days, disappear for a time, then come back again. Multiplied by a factor of 40 or 50, this made classroom continuity difficult. This irregularity, said one teacher, was a positive vice of the freedmen. A related weakness was unreliability. You can never depend on anything promised, when a typical complaint. Another general failing among the colored people, according to many teachers, was their tardiness at meetings, classes, church services, and so on. More serious were sexual offenses, theft, and lying. Many of the teachers blamed such behavior on slavery, but, as we have already seen, similar behavior was common among white rednecks on both sides of the Atlantic, people who had never been enslaved. Remarkably, the northern teachers persisted in the face of difficult students and a hostile white southern society from which they were excluded and by which they were sometimes terrorized. Although many teachers burned out in a few years, new teachers continued to arrive from New England and other parts of the North, thousands in the post-war decades. When black colleges were founded, New Englanders were again disproportionately represented among their teachers and college presidents, and much of these colleges' philosophy was that of New England. These institutions introduced strict behavioral standards, as well as high academic standards, imposing stern discipline and developing self-discipline in a region where such was not the norm for either blacks or whites. Noted black scholar and educator Charles S. Johnson said, "No less stern rectitude could have broken the grip of habits adjusted to a now outmoded life of irresponsibility and reshaped them to a new and serious purpose." W.E.B. Du Bois, himself a New Englander, and with the first Ph.D. from Harvard earned by a black man, declared the movement to plant the New England College in the South to be the salvation of the South and the Negro. Perhaps even more remarkable than these dedicated efforts was the fact that such efforts began to produce educational results early on. In 1871, the Georgia legislature created a board of visitors to attend public examinations at Atlanta University. The chairman of the first board of visitors was ex-slaveholder Joseph Brown, who reportedly said that he expected the examinations to confirm the Negro's inferiority. But the recitations of former slaves in Latin, Greek, and geometry forced from him the confession that we were impressed with the fallacy of the popular idea that the members of the African race are not capable of a high grade of intellectual culture. And the Atlanta Constitution could hardly believe what we witnessed. To see colored boys and girls 14 to 18 years of age reading in Greek and Latin and demonstrating correctly problems in algebra and geometry appears almost wonderful. However discordant the philosophy of the American Missionary Association may have been with multicultural views prevailing today, the crucial fact is that it worked, as so many of today's notions do not. There was yet another route by which New England culture reached some blacks in the 19th century. Oberlin College was founded by New Englanders in 1833, and it functioned as a New England college transplanted to Ohio, an outpost of New England culture beyond the Appalachians, as one scholar put it. It was also one of the few colleges to which blacks were admitted before the Civil War, as well as being a station on the Underground Railroad through which Southern blacks escaped from slavery. Although blacks were no more than 5% of the students at Oberlin College, Oberlin was a much more significant factor in the higher education of blacks. Of the 309 blacks who were known to have received a degree from a white college in America up through 1899, nearly half, 149, received their degrees from Oberlin. The first black woman to receive a college degree in America received it in Oberlin's class of 1862. She became the principal of a remarkable high school for blacks in Washington, D.C., discussed in a later essay as Dunbar High School. Of that school's first 10 principals, 3 were graduates of Oberlin, 2 graduated from Harvard, and 1 each from Amherst and Dartmouth. In essence, Most of this highly successful school's principals during its early formative period had New England educations and a New England culture, whether or not they received that education in New England itself. A wholly disproportionate share of future black leaders came out of the schools and colleges established by New Englanders in the South, not even counting Oberlin College or Dunbar High School. These alumni of institutions founded as New England enclaves in the South included W.E.B. Du Bois, James Weldon Johnson, Langston Hughes, Walter White, Mary McLeod Bethune, A. Philip Randolph, James Farmer, Thurgood Marshall, and Martin Luther King, Jr. In addition to these individuals from these Southern institutions, the first black man to graduate from Annapolis, the first black woman to earn a Ph.D., the first black general, the first black cabinet member, and the first black federal judge all came from the same public high school, Dunbar High School in Washington, with its culturally New England-educated principals in its formative years. Such concentrations of black pioneers and leaders in a few highly atypical cultural enclaves suggests that their achievements were not solely a matter of individual ability, cream rising to the top, but were also a result of a culture very unlike that in which most blacks were raised and educated. However much the achievements of these individuals have been celebrated, the culture behind those achievements has not been. Today, the culture that is celebrated in much of the media and in the schools is not the culture that succeeded, but the culture that has failed, the black redneck culture. When white couples who adopt black children are warned to be sure to put those children in touch with their cultural heritage, all too often that means the black redneck culture. Internal cultural differences. Internal cultural differences among blacks have long been extreme, ranging from such things as urbanization, education, and regional distribution, to rates of crime, economic achievement, and general acculturation to the norms of the surrounding society. Historically, the most fundamental difference for many generations was between those blacks who were slaves and those who were free. They differed not only in their legal status, but also in their regional distribution, their degree of urbanization, and even biologically. There were free blacks as far back as the 17th century. In fact, there were free blacks before there were slaves in America. The first Africans brought in captivity to colonial Virginia in 1619 became indentured servants, like the white indentured servants who were common in colonial America. Only later, with the mass importation of Africans, did this change. The first law in America recognizing perpetual slavery appeared in 1661 in Virginia. The small class of free blacks in colonial America had fewer restrictions than other free blacks would have in the 19th century, and many of them and their descendants made use of their opportunities. There was a black writer named Gustavus Vassa whose book was popular enough to go through 8 editions at a time when the vast majority of blacks were still illiterate slaves in the South. Benjamin Banneker was a publisher of almanacs and was also one of those who designed the layout of the city of Washington. Again, long before most blacks were either free or able to read and write. There were not just isolated individual blacks who were culturally more advanced than other blacks, but whole classes of blacks who had achieved cultural levels that most blacks would not achieve until many generations later. The size of the free black population increased after the United States came into existence as an independent nation, as the ideology of freedom associated with the American Revolution led most northern states to abolish slavery, and even in the South, enough white slave owners freed their slaves to cause the free black population there to nearly double and then redouble between 1790 and 1810. Both the regional distribution and the degree of urbanization of free and enslaved blacks differed greatly. After the invention of the cotton gin in 1793, the cotton plantations of the Deep South began to draw slaves away from Upper South states like Virginia and North Carolina, toward more southerly states like Mississippi and Alabama, sometimes as individuals sold down the river and often as part of whole plantations that relocated. Thus, the geographic center of the black population moved steadily southwestward at an average of about 50 miles per decade. Meanwhile, the free persons of color were moving in the directly opposite direction. While more than 90% of the antebellum black population lived in the South, the free persons of color were evenly divided between the states of the North and South, and, within the South, they tended to leave the Deep South and gravitate toward that region's less oppressive places farther north. The difference in geographic distribution was so extreme that in 1860, there were more free blacks living in the city of Washington alone than in the states of Mississippi, Alabama, and Georgia combined, these states having huge concentrations of slaves. The slave and the free also differed greatly in urbanization. While most black slaves worked in rural settings, by 1860, the free persons of color were more urbanized than even the white population. There were cultural consequences to these historic and geographic differences. While the vast majority of slaves could neither read nor write, the census of 1850 showed that most free persons of color were literate. But it would be half a century later, two generations after emancipation, before the same would be true of the black population as a whole. It would be 1940 before the black population as a whole became as urbanized as the free persons of color were in 1850. The cultural head starts of this segment of the black population had enduring consequences. The descendants of the antebellum free persons of color remained predominant among black leaders in many fields well into the 20th century, and they included W.E.B. Du Bois, Thomas Fortune, Charles Waddell Chestnut, Thurgood Marshall, John Hope Franklin, and many others. Most black holders of doctoral degrees in the middle of the 20th century, as well as most Negroes working in the professions in the nation's capital at that time, were by all indications descendants of the antebellum free persons of color, a group that was never more than 14% of the black population. As a group, the free persons of color also differed from the slaves in racial mixture. As in most of the Western Hemisphere, freed slaves were often the offspring of those who freed them, and the adults freed were more often female than male. While only 8% of slaves met the stringent U.S. Census requirement of half or more white ancestry to be classified as mulatto, 37% of the free persons of color did. This is not to say that all the others in either category were of pure African ancestry, but there were very noticeable skin color differences between the more acculturated descendants of those freed before the Civil War and those freed as a result of the Emancipation Proclamation. The noticeably greater success of the former was often attributed to their white ancestry, both by whites and by some of the Negro elite themselves. But the historical and cultural antecedents of that success are undeniable. Moreover, the later rise of other blacks to similar levels of achievement undermines the biological explanation of these internal differences among blacks. The point here is that cultural differences led to striking socioeconomic differences among blacks, as they did among whites. In both races, those who lived within the redneck culture lagged far behind those who did not. That these cultural differences among blacks also coincided with biological differences did not mean that biology explained the differences in performance. The offspring of white slave owners not only had a better chance of being freed, they also tended to have better opportunities while still enslaved, being more likely to be house servants rather than field hands, and, in some cases, living the lives of de facto free persons while still legally in bondage. Reconstruction-era black senator Blanche K. Bruce, for example, was during the era of slavery tutored alongside his owner's son, or other son, as many believed. During the antebellum era, there were other mulatto offspring of white slave owners who were given special consideration and aid. Some were sent to Oberlin College, sometimes with an intermediary handling financial arrangements, apparently to conceal the identity of the white father. This is not to say that most slave owners freed their mulatto offspring, but that, of those blacks freed voluntarily, mulattoes were far more common than among the slave population in general, and that women were freed more often than men. Moreover, this pattern prevailed throughout the Western Hemisphere. The point here is that the descendants of free persons of color had a cultural history that served them better than the cultural history of the descendants of slaves, even after the abolition of slavery ended differences in their legal status. Whether by individual escapes from slavery, by voluntary manumissions in the antebellum South, or by general emancipation by law in the northern states, A black class of free persons of color emerged long before the Emancipation Proclamation. The more prosperous of these families were able to educate their own children, sometimes through college, and these were typically lighter-skinned people, as well as people with generations of a head start in freedom and acculturation, as compared to the mass of enslaved blacks. The net result was that the elite among American Negroes tended to be, and to remain for generations after emancipation, a racially mixed group that married among themselves and formed a socially exclusive class. Among 19th-century Negroes in Philadelphia, for example, 85% of mulatto men married mulatto women, and 93% of black men married black women. This was not solely a matter of color prejudice, for there were major behavioral differences between the two groups. The mulatto neighborhoods had lower crime rates and a higher percentage of their children attending school, as compared to the black neighborhoods, even though it can hardly be claimed that school attendance or crime rates are genetically predetermined. In short, there were major cultural differences, and these differences in turn produced other differences, such as a higher occupational status, better housing, and more wealth among the mulattoes. Nor was this pattern confined to Philadelphia. All across the country, north and south, the elite of the Negro community were lighter in complexion than the masses, and very self-conscious, and sometimes snobbish, about that fact. This remained so through at least the first half of the 20th century. Among the consequences of the extreme range of education and acculturation within the Negro community has been the larger society's erection of racial barriers provoked by black rednecks, which barriers then deeply offended those individuals at the other end of the cultural spectrum. These barriers, based on race, prevented cultural elites from separating themselves as much as they would like from lower-class blacks, with whom they were forced to live in proximity and to share institutions. Yet, protests against racial barriers had to be made in the name of all, light or dark, leading to charges of hypocrisy against the elites who spearheaded protests against white social and economic barriers, while maintaining their own social and economic barriers against the black lower class. That internal social barriers within the black community became more pronounced at the same time as white barriers against blacks in general suggests that more than coincidence was involved, since both occurred in the wake of the mass arrival of black rednecks from the South. Among the behavioral differences between the black elites and the black masses was that the elites had more stable families, with separation or divorce being rare among them. It took more than money or a light complexion to enter the social circles of the black elite. Behavioral standards were also essential, and individuals who met these standards could be admitted with little money and regardless of complexion, though the history of black rednecks meant that few would rise to elite levels. External relations. Cultural differences affected not only the internal development of the black community, but also the way that the black community as a whole was treated by the larger surrounding white community, and the way in which that treatment varied over time. The small number of blacks who were free in colonial times were joined over the generations by increasing numbers of blacks who were either released from bondage or who escaped on their own. The growth of this largely unacculturated population, fugitives in the rough, in the words of black historian Carter G. Woodson, in northern cities during the first half of the 19th century, brought both social barriers and discriminatory laws barring black children from schools and black adults from equal access to public accommodations. Yet, as these black communities grew more acculturated over time and began to rise economically, these laws and practices began to be relaxed in many northern cities in the latter part of the 19th century. Writing in 1899, W.E.B. Du Bois noted a growing liberal spirit toward the Negro in Philadelphia, in which the community was disposed to throw off the trammels, brush away petty hindrances, and to soften the harshness of race prejudice, leading, among other things, to blacks being able to live in white neighborhoods. Jacob Riis noted similar changes in New York, and similar trends emerged in other northern cities in the last quarter of the 19th century. In Detroit, blacks who had been denied the vote in 1850 were voting in the 1880s, and in the 1890s, blacks were being elected to public office by a predominantly white electorate in Michigan. The black upper class in Detroit at that time had regular social interactions with whites, and their children attended high schools and colleges with whites. In Illinois, during the same era, legal restrictions on access to public accommodations for blacks were removed from the law, even though there were not enough black voters at the time to influence public policy, so that this represented changes in white public opinion. By all indications, northern black urban communities were themselves becoming cleaner, safer, and more orderly during this era of improving race relations, so changes in white public opinion were not merely inexplicable mood swings. Neither were the later retrogressions in race relations in the North, which followed a massive influx of black migrants from the South, black rednecks, at the beginning of the 20th century. As late as 1890, 9/10 of all blacks in the United States still lived in the South, but those who lived in northern urban communities were largely from families long settled there. Most blacks living in New York State, for example, were born in New York State. In short, there were settled communities in both regions, and by all indications, the northern black communities at that time were acculturating to the norms of the northern white society around them. But all of that changed radically within a relatively few years, as massive migrations from the South not only enlarged northern black communities, but transformed them culturally. In 1900, for the first time, more than half of all blacks living in New York State had been born outside that state. Newcomers from the South became growing majorities in northern urban black communities in other states as well. The record-breaking migrations of blacks from the South to the North during the first decade of the 20th century was nearly tripled during the second decade, and that in turn was almost doubled again during the decade of the 1920s. Moreover, the proportion of these migrants coming from the Deep South, as distinguished from the Upper South, increased over time, which meant that the least educated and least acculturated became a growing proportion of the black migrant population moving into the northern cities. There were about 30,000 blacks living in Chicago in 1900, but this grew to well over 100,000 by 1920 and more than 277,000 by 1940. In Detroit, the black population grew from a little more than 4,000 in 1900 to more than 40,000 in 1920 and over 149,000 by 1940. New York City's black population was a little more than 60,000 in 1900, but grew to more than 150,000 by 1920 and more than 450,000 by 1940. Writing in the midst of these massive migrations, historian Carter G. Woodson predicted, "The maltreatment of the Negro will be nationalized by this exodus." That is what had happened 100 years earlier, and now it happened again. The sheer numbers of these new black migrants from the South not only overwhelmed the relatively small black populations in northern cities demographically in the early 20th century, their very different behavior patterns shocked both blacks and whites at the time, as witnessed by adverse comments from earlier black settlers and the black press, denouncing the new arrivals from the South as vulgar, rowdy, unwashed, and criminal. Nor were these conclusions without foundation. For example, a study in early 20th century Pennsylvania found that the rate of violent crimes by blacks who had migrated there was nearly 5 times the rate of such crimes by blacks born in Pennsylvania. In Washington, the rate of births out of wedlock more than doubled with a large influx of Southern blacks during the late 19th century. One indication of the white reaction was that blacks no longer remained as free to live in white neighborhoods. This represented a major retrogression in race relations. In the late 19th century, racial segregation in housing in northern cities was no longer what it had once been, or what it would become again in the years ahead. In Detroit, as early as 1860, no neighborhood was even 50% black. In Chicago, as late as 1910, more than 2/3 of the black population lived in neighborhoods where most residents were white. But after the mass migrations of blacks from the South, attempts by blacks to move into white neighborhoods in Chicago were met with violence, including bombings. New York, Philadelphia, and Washington were also cities which began to restrict blacks to ghettos only after the massive influx of Southern blacks and their redneck culture. In many cities, blacks were prevented from moving into existing white neighborhoods, but in other cases, whites simply moved out when blacks moved in. Harlem, the first of the great northern black ghettos, was still predominantly white as late as 1910. Racial segregation in housing became an explicit law in Baltimore in 1911. In one way or another, residential segregation became the norm in northern cities. Residential segregation was not the only retrogression in race relations during this period. In some northern and midwestern cities where schools had been racially integrated for years, black children were now segregated from white children after the mass influx of blacks from the South. Blacks in Washington were no longer allowed in white theaters, restaurants, or hotels, and their opportunities to work in white-collar occupations shrank. W.E.B. Du Bois summarized these retrogressions this way. Yet it has everywhere been manifest in the long run that while a part of the Negroes were native-born and trained in the culture of the city, the others were immigrants, largely ignorant and unused to city life. There were, of course, manifold exceptions, but this was the rule. Thus, the history of the Negro in northern cities is the history of the rise of a small group by accretion from without, but at the same time periodically overwhelmed by them and compelled to start over again when once the material had been assimilated. In Philadelphia, for example, the native-born blacks had advanced, but, according to Du Bois, they were overwhelmed and dragged back by black migrants from the South. He added, in New York, the native-born have been perhaps even more completely overwhelmed. This pattern is confirmed in places where the retrogression in race relations took place at a different time because of local differences in the timing of large-scale in-migration of blacks from the South. In San Francisco, for example, that mass influx took place during the Second World War, as blacks from the South were attracted by jobs in new war production facilities, notably the Kaiser Shipyards. Henry Kaiser recruited Southern blacks and brought them to the San Francisco Bay Area by the trainloads. The black population of San Francisco, which had been less than 5,000 in 1940, rose to more than 40,000 by the time of the 1950 census, and the black populations of Oakland and Berkeley also rose several-fold during the same decade. In the San Francisco Bay Area, as in the northern cities half a century earlier, there was a long-settled black population which lived free of the Jim Crow laws and practices of the South, and which had been able to get civil service jobs as far back as the 1920s. But although the newcomers were skilled workers more often than the local black residents, culturally, the newcomers lagged far behind. Native-born blacks in the Bay Area described the newcomers as foreign in the way they talked and in their behavior. For example, eating hamburgers openly on the bus, and bologna, and loud talking and fighting on the buses. That never happened in the old days. Some of the new blacks from the South were described as having a little more of a chip on their shoulder than the people out here did. Many local blacks thought that white racism increased after World War II, when both Southern blacks and Southern whites began arriving in large numbers. A similar retrogression in race relations on the Pacific Coast during the Second World War occurred in Portland, Oregon, where again there were large influxes of black workers to take jobs in the growing war industries. These new black arrivals with little education were resented by the small group of law-abiding and self-sustaining Negroes already living in Portland. As in other places and times, a ghetto now developed in Portland, and discriminations in regard to civil rights were instituted. On the national scene, the much later receding of racism and the socioeconomic advancement of blacks in the second half of the 20th century cannot be attributed simply to the passage of time, for the passage of time had produced major retrogressions in race relations before. Nor can these advances be attributed to the civil rights laws that began in the 1960s, for the advancement of blacks antedated any serious civil rights legislation by years, and was in fact more dramatic in the years preceding such legislation. Between 1940 and 1960, the percent of black families with incomes below the official poverty line fell from 87% to 47%. In various skilled trades, the income of blacks relative to whites more than doubled between 1936 and 1959. The principal factor that raised black incomes during that period, both absolutely and relative to white income, was migration, from low-income areas to higher-income areas. However much these migrations set back those blacks who are already living in northern cities, this movement from the south put millions of blacks into places where their children would get better education, while their parents had better job opportunities. With the passing years and generations, more and more of these migrant families ceased to be black rednecks, acculturating themselves in new surroundings, as minority groups tend to do in countries around the world. Once again, racial barriers began to erode after World War II and before the civil rights legislation of the 1960s. Perhaps the most dramatic example was the crumbling of racial barriers in professional sports, exemplified by Jackie Robinson's becoming the first black Major League Baseball player in 1947, 17 years before the Civil Rights Act of 1964. A poll that year showed his popularity to be second only to longtime entertainment idol Bing Crosby. The process of ending racial segregation in American military services was also begun during the Truman administration, years before segregation was declared unlawful in civilian life. In 1948, President Harry Truman ran for re-election on a platform that included civil rights for blacks, which some thought would doom his candidacy. But the fact that he won suggests that white public opinion had already begun to change. The Civil Rights Act of 1964 and the Voting Rights Act of 1965 dealt major blows to racial restrictions, especially in the South, and had dramatic effects on the number of black elected officials. Economically, however, the upward trends in black income and occupations that had begun decades earlier simply continued, but at no accelerated rate. The rise of blacks into professional and other high-level occupations was in fact greater in the years preceding the Civil Rights Act of 1964 than in the years afterward, and was greater in the 1940s than in the 1950s. Behind such developments was the fact that blacks were closing the gap between themselves and whites in years of schooling during this era. In short, major social transformations within the black community were having an impact in their economic condition. It would hardly be surprising if it also had an impact on how whites viewed blacks, as had happened in the 19th century. The civil rights legislation of the 1960s may well have been an effect of the rise of blacks, rather than the sole or predominant cause of that rise, as it has been represented as being, by those leaders, black and white, with incentives to magnify their own role in racial progress. The difference between cultural explanations of changing race relations and explanations based on political acts or swings of the pendulum in white public opinion is not just a matter of intellectual preference. There are wholly different implications, not only about the past, but especially about the future. The question is whether the advancement of blacks is helped or hindered by promoting a black identity built around a redneck culture whose track record has been largely negative for both blacks and whites. White liberals. White liberals in many roles, as intellectuals, politicians, celebrities, judges, teachers, have aided and abetted the perpetuation of a counterproductive and self-destructive lifestyle among black rednecks. The welfare state has made it economically possible to avoid many of the painful consequences of this lifestyle that forced previous generations of blacks and whites to move away from the redneck culture and its values. Lax law enforcement has enabled the violent and criminal aspects of this culture to persist, and non-judgmental intellectual trends have enabled it to escape moral condemnation. As far back as 1901, W.E.B. Du Bois, while complaining of racial discrimination against blacks, also condemned indiscriminate charity for its bad effects within the black community. In a later era, the burgeoning welfare state, especially since the 1960s, has spread an indiscriminate charity in both money and attitudes that has given the black redneck culture a new lease on life. Intellectuals have been particularly prominent among those who have turned the black redneck culture into a sacrosanct symbol of racial identity. This includes both black and white intellectuals, though the latter predominate numerically and in terms of influence through the media and academia. Intellectuals have promoted misconceptions of history, misreadings of contemporary life, and counterproductive notions of how to prepare for the future. By projecting a vision of a world in which the problems of blacks are consequences of the actions of whites, either immediately or in times past, White liberals have provided a blanket excuse for shortcomings and even crimes by blacks. The very possibility of any internal cultural sources of the problems of blacks have been banished from consideration by the fashionable phrase, blaming the victim. But no one can be blamed for being born into a culture that evolved in centuries past, even though moving beyond such a culture may do more for future advancement than blaming others or seeking special dispensations. Blaming others. Blaming others for anything in which blacks lag has become standard operating procedure among white liberals. If blacks do not pass bar exams or medical board tests as often as whites or Asians, then that shows that something is wrong with those tests, as far as many white liberals are concerned. Best-selling author Andrew Hacker, for example, says that academic problems in general are created for black students in white colleges because such colleges use curricula that are white in logic and learning in their conceptions of scholarly knowledge and demeanor. Why this does not seem to be a problem for Asian students remains unexplained, even though blacks have lived in this white society for centuries longer than either Asian Americans or contemporary immigrants from Asia. Why it is not a problem for blacks from the Caribbean is another unexplained contradiction of such white liberal excuses for American-born blacks. If black attorneys are not elevated to partnerships in law firms in proportion to their numbers, then to the New York Times this shows, in the words of their front page headline, "Law firms are slow in promoting minority lawyers to partner role." Apparently, there can only be external reasons for anything negative that happens to blacks. According to Andrew Hacker, the fact that white taxi drivers often pass up black males seeking a ride, especially at night, shows these drivers to be patently racist, even though black taxi drivers do the same in order to avoid becoming victims of crime. White liberals long denied that there were higher crime rates among blacks by pointing to the imperfections of crime statistics in general, or, more specifically, claiming that blacks are simply arrested more often for things that whites would not be arrested for. But if the imperfections of crime statistics were the real problem, then discussions could be limited to murder statistics, since dead bodies are not ignored, whether they are black or white, and neither are murderers, whatever their race. But murder statistics show the same disproportionate number of crimes by blacks as other statistics do. While murder statistics might provide more accuracy, they would not provide white liberals with a means of evading the obvious. Riots by blacks are almost automatically blamed on whites, whether in the Kerner Report on the riots of the 1960s or in the reactions among white liberals to the Los Angeles riots of 1992. In some white liberal circles, the New York Times, for example, the police are almost automatically at fault in confrontations with black criminals, hoodlums, or rioters. When the police arrive on a scene of crime or violence in black communities, whatever they do is likely to be categorized later as either having let the situation get out of hand or as having used excessive force. Any force sufficient to prevent the situation from getting out of hand is almost certain to be called excessive force by white liberals in the media, so that, by definition, the police will have acted badly, no matter what they did or failed to do. Should the police arrive in such overwhelming numbers as to bring the disorder to a quick halt without any need to use force at all, then they will often be said to have overreacted by sending so many cops to deal with unresisting people. One of the reactions of the police to such predictable scapegoating in the media has been to depolice some of the most violent black neighborhoods, looking the other way rather than risk seeing a whole career ruined by media charges of racism. This gives criminals, hoodlums, and rioters a freer hand at the expense of law-abiding blacks, who may be the great majority, even in a high-crime neighborhood. There is evidence that this is in fact what happens after a barrage of adverse media coverage against the police. The incorrigibility of white society and the corresponding futility of black efforts to improve their situation by improving their own education and other qualifications is another leitmotif of much white liberal writing. After the U.S. Supreme Court struck down some racially gerrymandered congressional districts, forcing some black members of Congress to run in districts where most voters were white, New York Times columnist Anthony Lewis said, "The reality in the South is that black men and women, however well qualified, have little chance of winning in white districts." But these Southern black candidates were, in fact, reelected. The fact that black rednecks exhibit the same hostility and violence toward other minorities, long associated with bigoted white rednecks in the South, presents white liberals with another challenge to find a way to evade the obvious. Black anti-Semitism, for example, is not recognized by Andrew Hacker, who claims that no one really knows if blacks and whites differ markedly in their feelings about Jews, despite survey after survey showing greater hostility to Jews among blacks. Black hostility to other minorities, such as the Koreans, has likewise often been ignored by such liberal publications as the New York Times, or even defined out of existence by a variety of white liberal writers on grounds that racism requires power, which blacks do not have. Following that logic, Nazis were not anti-Semites until they gained control of the German government, and the Ku Klux Klan today would not be called racist anymore because it has lost the power it once had. But the arbitrary proviso of power was never part of the definition of racism until racism among blacks became widespread enough to require a convenient evasion. The thuggish gutter words and brutal hoodlum lifestyle of gangster rap musicians are not merely condoned but glorified by many white intellectuals, and understood by others lacking the courage to take responsibility for siding with savagery. The National Council of Teachers urged the use of hip-hop in urban classrooms. The cultural editor of the San Francisco Chronicle characterized rapper Tupac Shakur as a lightning rod of insurrection in the name of social justice. USA Today said, "Gangster rap is rooted in part in underfunded school systems which fail to equip students with the skills to speak out effectively and intersect with larger communities." An article in the New Republic said that rap music has become the nearest thing to a political voice of the poor. Michael Gilmore of Rolling Stone wrote of all the terrible forces responsible for such a wasteful, unjustifiable end to the life of rapper Tupac Shakur by the very lawless violence he had sung of and lived, not by some mysterious forces. The blaming of gangster rap barbarism on social conditions takes many forms, such as that of a Boston Globe columnist who depicted it as deriving from the institutional indifference that thrives wherever poor people assemble in America. Struggling schools, dangerous streets, long-gone factories, hospital emergency rooms or EMTs substituting for family doctors, futures measured by sunsets and sunrises, and the dull feeling that nearly everything is against